Are we ready?
Yeah.
Cool. Hello? Hello? Oh, hi. This is the Dusty Stacks of the Digital Archives or Axis of Access. Anyway, we're still working on the title. It's an open collaboration between the four of us here. But this is a podcast where we are getting together. There's four of us here, and we want to discuss insularity in the digital humanities, where we want to talk about who is part of digital humanities, who gets access to digital humanities, and what do these different levels of access mean for DH and for the digital world. But first, what is insularity?
Insularity, known, ignorism, or lack of interest in, cultures, ideas, or peoples outside one's own experience, detached, standing alone, isolated.
So, going off of that, I think it's still kind of unclear what insularity is, but each of us is bringing something different to this conversation, so why don't we introduce ourselves? Natalie, do you want to start?
I can start. I'm Natalie. Primarily during... when I start talking about my topic, I'm just going to focus on the relationship between the digital humanities and like libraries and how there's a relationship there and how library culture in itself can be a little insular and how that impacts the way DH in itself can be kind of insular.
And you work in the library here, right?
Yeah.
And you're a library science major.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool.
I'm Jane. I'm interested in DH and the question of insularity because I study public humanities, and so I think a lot about the distribution of access to university resources, and I think that DH can play a really crucial role in that.
And I'm Carly. I'm sort of coming from this from a different perspective. I'm somebody who is interested in digital infrastructures and history of tech, and so I'm really looking at how DH is appropriating and dealing with histories of technology and culture and how the values that sort of have founded a lot of like the startup tech culture have infiltrated or not into the digital humanities.
Cool, thanks. And I'm Isabel, and I come from a geography background, and I'm really interested in GIS as like a digital tool, but mostly for public activism and creating social change. So that also spreads to other areas of digital humanities and how it maybe doesn't necessarily live just within the university and could be used as a tool to make a better world. Great, well, thank you all for introducing yourself. We went out into the field, actually, because we started thinking that we're so familiar with digital humanities and what it is, but we wanted to know if this term means anything or what does it mean to people out on campus. So here's some recordings of the answers to that question.
What the digital humanities are? No, sorry, I don't know.
Are you able to name any digital humanities project?
I'm sorry, but no.
Let's see, this is happening.
Are you going to ask me a question or do I just have to? Okay,
yeah. No. All right, Catherine, what's your experience with digital humanities?
I've encountered digital humanities partially through some coursework that I've done, which has always been a really interesting experience because I've had to switch from my kind of default genre of academic language to a more accessible way of writing. And I guess I've also encountered public humanities through like, you know, digital archives and things that are publicly accessible, which is also great just for my odd curiosities and also for my academic work.
A wide variety of responses.
Yeah. No.
I'd say. it's interesting to me in the last one, this was a friend of ours, and to be fair, she's fully an academic, fully ensconced in the language of the academy. But the thing that she brought up first when she started talking about DH is accessibility and how she like had to make the language that she was using in digital projects more accessible and more open. So I just thought that was an interesting thing, like of the one person that we found that like did know what digital humanities was. That was something that they were interested in talking about.
I wonder also like how many of those people that said no maybe have engaged with a digital humanities project, but wouldn't have used that language to identify it. Like in a kind of digital world, I think so many things could be categorized as digital humanities, but might not use that like epistemological term for categorizing that work.
And I think it really forced us to think about who is having access to this. So the one person who said she is familiar with DH stuff is an academic, and the other people weren't familiar. And so it's really kind of reinforcing notions that people in academic circles know about DH, but people outside of it really are unfamiliar so far.
What's, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, like, I had a conversation with one of the people after they didn't know what it was, and after some reflection, they kind of realized that they could think of things that were digital humanities based. But I think it's kind of funny that, like you guys are saying, like, that's not the kind of language some people use to describe it. Like, they'll just look at, like, they'll be on Instagram and, like, in a way that is a DH project, but, like, they're not really thinking about that.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting, too, like, within the academy, maybe who knows about DH and who would identify as somebody that works with DH is also different. And one of these quotes that, one of the quotes from my research that really stuck out to me is from Dorothy Kim and Jesse Stomel in a book they wrote called Disrupting the Digital Humanities. And they said, many scholars originally were drawn to the digital humanities because we felt like outcasts, because we had been marginalized within the academic community. So like, I just think that adds another layer of like within the academy, who's identifying with DH, and is that already a kind of outcast group?
Well, it's interesting too, because it seems like academics within the academy who like are identifying with DH and are DH scholars are people kind of taking up a lot of the kind of tech norms, like from the like renegade tech days of the 70s and 80s, when all that was starting, and in that like they do see themselves as outsiders. They do see themselves as like people disrupting the status quo in some way. So it's interesting to see that transfer. And there is kind of a lag time too, because obviously the stuff in the tech industry was happening in the 70s and 80s. This is happening now in 2020.
Yeah.
But I think it's a great point.
Were the 70s and 80s when like these open access journals started, or is that later? Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, so the idea and practice of providing free online access to journal articles started at least a decade before open access was formally coined as a term in 2002. Computer scientists and early sort of tech wizards, tech gurus, have been employing early open access principles in anonymous file transfer protocol archives since the 1970s. And there's one scientist who had this call known as the Subversive Protocol that was an influential call for researchers online to practice open archival practices, and that was posted in 1994. Since then, and as of February of last year, February 2019, there are over 12,500 open access journals, and over a quarter of peer-reviewed academic articles are open access, which I found really interesting. Particularly because it is taking that language of disruption that the tech industry has been using for years into the academic publishing market. The academic publishing market, led by a publisher known as Elsevier, can be considered sort of an oligarchic sort of form of knowledge in the academic sphere. That publishing market, the academic publishing market, has an annual revenue of $25.2 billion, which is insane to me. Somebody who's worked in commercial publishing, and it's really not that high. And in 2013, Elsevier, one of the leaders in the academic publishing market, reported a higher percentage of profits than Apple, which was sort of a staggering statistic
wow.
to me. And so it's really sort of showing like publishers are making a lot of money out of being insular, basically. And the practice of open access within the academy is really serving to disrupt that industry. And this has been happening in informal ways alongside sort of the more open access, like more formal peer-reviewed journals. I know as a student I've used like the pirating website called ARG, and the R's and the A's are constantly changing to sort of
evade. they don't want you to be able to find it again, right?
Yeah,
I mean it
exactly.
is not legal.
No, and it's a way of sort of getting academic resources without sort of having the academic credentials And there's a movement on Twitter. There's a hashtag called CanIHasPDF, where people will sort of ask for a PDF of an article with that hashtag, and the academics of Twitter will graciously give them the PDF of the article.
Have you, I know Jane Brunson, have you ever used that feature? Like, have you ever tried to get a PDF via Twitter that way?
Yeah, so I've never used it, but I teach English 105, and I had a research librarian talk to my class, and she was talking about the enormous paywalls that exist for people who are trying to find research and when they aren't affiliated with the university. And so she even suggested to my students that if they, for some reason, want to find something that the university isn't subscribed to, they could use the CanIHasPDF hashtag, or even she suggested reaching out directly to the researcher, because she was making the point that a lot of researchers want their work to be more accessible, and the publishing companies are really just profiting off of the universities and the researchers, and the researchers aren't getting anything by having their things be so insular.
That just makes me think of this idea of, like, you know, in order to use the library, the library's amazing, the libraries here are amazing, and there's so many resources, but as soon as I lose my onion in, like, 5 months, I'm not going to have any of those resources. And I have a lot of friends that have graduated, and they will be, they're working in jobs, or they're working creatively, and they're doing projects, and they'll find an article they want to use, or a book they want to access, or an ebook they want to access, and they, like, they know how to use the library search engine, they know how to use UNC libraries, and then they get to the point where they have to log in, and they'll call me and be like, Isabel, I need to use your onion to read this article. And it's wild to me how that now is, like, a valuable thing that I have and that I'm going to lose. And I don't know, maybe that, like, gets into our conversation about libraries and the power that they hold in keeping things insular. Or also, I think a lot of librarians, I mean, you know this from the SIL school, maybe want everything to be public, and they're also working within these, like, structural constraints of publishing and tenure and jobs and money and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I definitely think that relates, especially because, like, I work at Davis Library, and as a student or as a faculty member or staff member, we do get a lot of privileges that, like, someone unaffiliated with the university or someone doing research on their own, like, they don't get the same tools that we would, especially, like, online tools, because, like, someone can sign up for a borrower's card. They'd have to pay, like, a yearly subscription for it.
How much is it?
It's, like, I think it's, like, $25 a year, which, like, isn't bad, but, like, they don't really get the same access. Because, for one, starters, they'll get physical access to books, like, they can check out books. But if you're a new member, there's limitations. Like, you have to build a kind of trust with the university. And also, like, their access to digital tools and, like, digital, like, ebooks, all that stuff is, like, very limited, because they cannot access it from home. Like, they don't have an onion like we do, where we can just, I could be in bed and just, like, looking at articles, and, like, that's fine. They would have to be, like, physically in the library, and they would have to be using, like, a computer within the library. And even then, they only get an hour a day. Like, sometimes, like, librarians will, like, kind of give, oh, I'll give you an extra 30 minutes because, like, the library notes here, like, we'll give you an extra 30 minutes. But I think, like, there is a way in which, like, even with this access, it remains insular. And, like, it really just depends on, like, who you're talking to. Like, someone might help you and give you more access. They may help you print something out. But, like, I don't know. It's interesting to see how, like, libraries as this, like, tool, like, libraries in itself are, like, a huge tool, like, a digital humanities tool. Just, like, the fact that, like, there's a research hub, there's so many, like, digital tools available for researching, but I don't know. It's just interesting there's a limitation there.
I mean, can you imagine if, like, because it's digital, you can have things like you can only be online for an hour, and the computer can automatically log you out. But you can never imagine going to Davis and somebody being like, okay, you have to leave in an hour. Like, we're going to physically kick you out of the space.
Yeah.
So, like, digitizing these knowledges creates new ways of making them insular that we weren't able to. Even with a book, you know, you could take a book out of the library, and now the digital, it makes things much more ephemeral, I think.
Yeah, and it's sort of bringing the insularity of the academy online in a weird way. I guess my question is, like, do you think the digital humanities has a responsibility to sort of uphold open access principles? I don't know, it's just something I've been thinking about. And I think it does, in that it sort of was founded on the belief that more knowledge is better, and the more people have knowledge, the better it is. But I'm curious to get your thoughts on that.
I mean, I think maybe just because we've been talking about this idea of, like, data and corporations owning data and governments owning data, like, that data is valuable because people have tools to use it for what they want. So whether that's Netflix using that for advertising or the government using that for surveillance, but, like, those are also tools that academics can learn and members of the public can learn, and we can develop new tools to do things that are really transformative and good. And what we need is access to the data and knowledge and sharing of those tools. And so I think, like, digital humanities, at least right now, is really well situated to provide those tools and bring people into this world where data doesn't have to be this, like, looming, scary thing that's going to ruin all our lives. It could be something that we can use to improve our lives, or at least to fight against people who want to, I don't know. I am, like, super skeptical of big data, obviously. But it's really, like, whenever I go to the library and I talk to a digital librarian or someone, and they, like, are like, look at all these tools you can use, look at all these data things, like, I want to help you, I want to provide this for you. I'm like, oh, there's a chance that we're going to get through this phase.
Yeah. Which would be good.
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know. There's at the same time that there is, like, this sort of optimism working in the digital humanities, there's equal amounts of kind of skepticism and optimism kind of at play in the digital humanities, and how responsible, like, both private companies and academic institutions and, like, just regular people out in the world kind of use data and trust the public with the stuff that they're making. It's interesting. I found this interview with Jimmy Wales, who is the founder of Wikipedia, sort of talking about the publishing practices of Wikipedia and how editing works on the site. So I'll just play that and we can respond.
I'm eager to start locking things down, but I just assumed we were going to have to. And as it turns out, Wikipedia, even today, is still incredibly open. There's always been this sort of story arc in the media that, oh, well, it used to work and it was really wide open, but of course they had to lock everything down when it got bigger. But that story started to fade over the years because the media started to realize, actually, it's still very, very open, and they didn't have to lock everything down. You know, what we've tried to do is just be very subtle with how the controls work and things like that. But you know, it's something that sometimes people say, oh, he just believed with the world that everybody could be trusted. Well, I'm not sure I believed it or not, but I thought it was worth a go. That was really more accurate. And then it proved over time that, you know, yeah, there's a tiny percentage of people who are incredibly annoying, but most people are basically decent and won't wreck things and find ways to work together.
All right. So, yeah, that's Jimmy Wales talking about, like, I don't know, the quote that stuck out for me from that was that trusting people is worth the go. And that's sort of, like, the ethos that Wikipedia was founded on, is sort of an open access site where, like, anybody can kind of go in under the principles of editing and edit whatever Wikipedia article it was. And it's, like, now become, like, a real resource for people on the internet. That's, like, where everybody goes first when they're trying to learn about something.
Yeah, that makes me think about, like, so we talked about open source journals, but there's also, not the same thing, but similar terminology, which is, I want to say open source software. So, like, for GIS, the main open source software is called QGIS. And basically, like, it's open access, anybody can download it, and people can write their own plugins, and it's constantly evolving through the work of this kind of collaborative work of people who want to make it a better software for doing basically geography data visualization. And the flip side of that is ArcGIS, which is like the private version of a GIS software, and it's super, super expensive. It's pretty inaccessible for anyone who's not making a ton of money off of it. And it's designed by this company Esri. So actually, in reality, like, a lot of people who are more DH, a lot of academics who are more, like, working in DH fields, I think tend to use QGIS because they can collaborate, they can use plugins, they can, like, it's much more flexible. And I think that has to do with this idea of optimism of, like, oh, we can work to, like, we can all work together and see what happens. And oftentimes the product is actually better and more flexible than what could ever be produced by a one track. Like, can you imagine if there was a group that wrote every single Wikipedia article? They wouldn't be able to do it. You know, it is inherently needs to be collaborative and open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this sort of reminds me of something that we talked about in earlier, like, research planning meetings about the tragedy of the commons and how sort of that was like a, like, something that people in DH were maybe afraid of, but maybe, like, with the things that we found, maybe they shouldn't be afraid of. So the concept of the tragedy of the commons, it's pretty widely used concept in environmental studies in particular, but it's basically, like, I sort of compared it to the Starbucks bathroom concept. Like, basically the more people have access to a space, like, the worse it gets. Like, the more people using a public bathroom, like, the grosser the public bathroom is, basically.
Lovely.
Lovely. You're welcome. But that is sort of a fear that, like, I could see somebody like Jimmy Wales having, in opening Wikipedia up to be edited by, like, whoever wants to edit it. But I think there's a lot of evidence, in sort of, like, in maybe not as radical of an openness as, like, Jimmy Wales saying whoever wants to edit Wikipedia can edit Wikipedia, but there's a lot of evidence in other DH projects, where, like, more access, more sort of, like, chaotic, collaborative, like, work together makes the product better and, like, shares information more widely. And so I was wondering, I know a couple of you have looked at different projects kind of that support that thesis.
Yeah, so we've talked about a couple of different projects. One that I think is really interesting to this conversation is Project Gutenberg, because it kind of is similar to Wikipedia in the interface that it uses. And it began in 1971, actually, so it's a really old ebook software, kind of. And it's predicated on the goal of making as many e-texts available to as many people as possible. So I have an excerpt from their mission statement here, which says, "The Project Gutenberg e-texts should cost so little that no one will really care how much they cost. They should be a general size that fits on the standard media of the time. And the Project Gutenberg e-texts should be so easily used that no one should ever have to care about how to use, read, quote, and search them." So the goal of this project was really to digitize as many books as possible and make them freely available. So if you think of, like, a library software like OverDrive or something that has a limited number of copies, but Project Gutenberg has as many copies as you want, so however many people can download them for free. But because of working within copyright law, it has to be out of copyright, so they tend to be older texts, but a lot of students use them, teachers use them, and it's a really great publicly available resource that does something really cool with DH, I think.
Oh, interesting. I always associate Project Gutenberg, like, with really old stuff. But what is the term for, like, old stuff that is accessible? Is there, like, open...
Public domain.
Public domain. That's the term I'm looking for.
Yeah.
I think a project that maybe is, like, on the opposite end, not opposite end of the spectrum, but, like, quite different, is, because I think of that as being about, like, access to knowledge, and a project that I've been reading about is called the Anti-Eviction Mapping Project, and it's grew out of housing justice organizers in San Francisco that identified evictions happening across the downtown area in San Francisco, and they wanted to visualize those because that could be a tool for them to explain what was happening. A lot of people didn't believe that evictions were happening and illegal evictions were happening. And they use a lot of GIS software and digital storytelling software to visualize that data and share it, both in kind of legal settings to get to work on this housing justice project, but also to share it, like, across the country. And a lot of it is available on Twitter, on their website. And that made me think about, like, the same thing of different projects approaching, a lot of DH projects are about access, and put that in their mission statement and put that in their kind of main goals. And I'm sure there are DH projects that aren't like that, but we couldn't find them because they were insular.
Yeah, honestly, like a lot of the ones I can think of too are like very like focused on like public access, because I know that like when I was doing my report, I was like researching the Media History Digital Library, which was like some project that someone started, and it basically like takes like a bunch of different like publishing about cinema and like all the like just like cinema records. And like it's like 2 million records online, and they even have like this thing on the site where like you can manually like make trends and like analyze the data. So I feel like, I don't know, DH projects, like they I feel like a lot, like at least the ones I've seen, kind of encourage like this access to a lot of information that then you can use to make your like own research.
Yeah, it's generally very optimistic, I think, or our conversations tend towards this space of like, actually this is really cool, this is exciting.
Yeah.
Despite maybe what, like, something that also came up is it's very exciting, except when you have to, like, go back to your office and publish an article because you're an academic and you need to get tenure, or you, there's maybe, it's not insular outside of the university, but then inside of the university, all of a sudden, all of those structures, like, come back down.
Yeah, so we did a little bit of research into the relationship between DH and tenures, tenure cases and tenure reviews, and so we actually dug into the tenure standards for the English department here, and they have a little bit of inclusion of DH stuff, so I have a short passage here that I can share. So the Department of English and Comparative Literature recognizes faculty who conduct or publish their research digitally for their innovation and for moving beyond traditional formats. The standard for excellence is the same for digital and non-digital work and may include influence on a scholarly field, rigorous peer reviews, or other evaluation by experts in the area. The overall quality and contribution of the work must be measured against the university's long-standing high standards, which should be independent of the mode or medium of publication. So it's exciting that digital work is included in the tenure standards at all, but there's some limitations here, one of which is that it still has to be evaluated in kind of more traditional forms, even if it's pushing outside those boundaries. And another is that the onus is on the researcher to make the case for why their work is actually scholarship rather than an underlying assumption that it just is, which I think is problematic for a lot of people. And a couple of other things, like not everyone who's on a tenure committee is going to be knowledgeable about DH work, so it might not get the weight that it deserves because people don't really understand how to evaluate it. And often it's collaborative, which is really given pretty much no weight in a tenure case. So in 2008, the MLA released a framework for evaluating digital scholarship and really was trying to stress the importance of recognizing new forms of scholarship. So change is happening, but academic change happens very slowly. So
yeah.
It's encouraging, but slow.
And I'm like, yeah, it's within the academy, this change is happening slowly, but outside, like, having digital skills is super important for, I mean, we talk about, or a lot of people have brought this up in this class, is like, oh, I want these skills so I can get a job, but not an academic job. So there's also that tension.
Yeah.
Yeah, it strikes me that, like, sort of in talking about, like, DH projects and how we could only find ones that were sort of outside looking, more public facing, like, in attempting to be more accessible. I'm teaching my students, some public writing projects and some public writing kind of ethos, and we're developing the ethos of public writing as a class. And a big part of that is asking the question of so what? And like giving your writing stakes, giving your research stakes. And it strikes me that digital humanities projects, like Project Gutenberg, like the anti-eviction mapping project and many others, kind of do that so what work very, very well.
Well, I think, you know, it's good to know that there's some optimism left in the digital world, and that DH is, you know, you can find it, we found all of our resources mostly for this online, I found a lot of academic articles accessible online, so it's happening, and it's slow, but I think it's great. Yeah, does anybody have last things to say before we sign off?
I think you nailed it.
Great, well, thank you.
All right.
Hi.
Whoops.
You want to play our sound?
Well, I was trying to do the goodbye sound.
Goodbye.
You got mail. Welcome. You got mail.
Oops, okay. Stop. I think that was 30 minutes.
Yeah.
I just timed it based on what the time was.
Yeah, maybe a little under or a little bit.